morning. We're delighted to see all of you, but we have a special welcome for the Stockbridge High School students who are with us. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are invited to come and join us for an oral argument. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case we're about to hear, and they may engage in some activities relating to this case. They come to court, listen to oral argument, and will meet with a justice who's been assigned to meet with them. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases. There will not be a discussion on the substantive issues involved in these cases. Everyone is welcome to join the justices. And the discussion will be in the courtroom after the second case this morning. If you would like a summary of the case you're about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, the marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to listen to the case and understand it if you have a basic knowledge of the facts and the legal issues. Anyone want a summary? All right. With that introduction, I'll now introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Pat Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice with whom you're going to meet at lunch. And to Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case for today, which is 10 AP 1192 CR, State versus Rashawn Smith. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Rashawn Smith, is William E. Schmall, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is William Schmall. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, Appellate Division, and I'm arguing the case this morning for Rashawn Smith. By way of introduction, the court is already aware that this case presents two substantial issues, each of which has been fully briefed separately. And I believe there are a number of issues that need to be addressed here this morning. By virtue of the time limitations, I intend to speak more directly with the court than I ordinarily might if a lesser number of issues were involved, and I would urge the court to do the same with me in return. The two issues, in summary, are a question of how the sufficiency of evidence should be reviewed when a case is presented by way of circumstantial evidence. The second issue involves what should happen when a person who is on trial waives a jury trial without an adequate inquiry into whether that's what the person really wants to do. I'm here primarily to address your questions and to respond to your challenges, but I will address each of these two questions in turn to the extent that I have the opportunity to do so. I have given a handout to the marshal with the court's permission to be distributed to each of the justices. It consists of an excerpted copy of this court's decision in State versus Pollinger, which is the primary case dealing with the review of circumstantial evidence. It contains five yellow highlighted areas, and I will be referring to those during my comments. May those be distributed.
Have you shown that to opposing counsel? Ms. Wellman, have you seen it? Do you have any objection? Marcia? You may proceed, counsel.
With respect to the sufficiency of circumstantial evidence in a criminal case, I commence from the common ground that I think is beyond dispute, that a jury must find proof beyond a reasonable doubt before it can return a conviction. And we instruct the jury, as it was instructed in this case, that it must exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence before it can find the person guilty.
Can I ask you a question at the outset? If the jury, it's my understanding, both in trying these cases as a lawyer and as a judge, that the jury is instructed regarding the underlying offense, and then they're asked to answer a second question, if these questions were submitted to the jury, and that deals with amount, right?
Yes.
Okay. If a jury answers guilty as to the underlying offense, but says that the state hasn't met its burden of proof as to the amount, do you think the defendant is guilty or not guilty?
That's a tricky question. We know from the law that the jury is required to decide the amount because that can affect the penalty.
Penalty, right? But
yes.
Does that affect the conviction of the underlying offense?
I think it does, although, again, there isn't a clear-cut answer. I say that essentially for two reasons. If we look at the definition of this particular offense, which is possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver, we find the weight defined as in the very same statute and as essentially as a part of the offense. So I think the better view is that it is part of the offense itself.
And if the jury finds that the defendant possessed a controlled substance with intent to deliver and finds the defendant guilty of that offense, but then goes on to answer the second question and doesn't give a specific amount or thinks that it, while there was a delivery, we can't find that the state met its burden that it was 10,000 grams, let's say. You think then the guilty becomes a not guilty?
I'm suggesting that the way you framed the question, the jury finds the defendant guilty of the offense but does not find a weight, is not entirely accurate, because I think you can't be found guilty under the most natural reading of this statute without also finding the weight.
Really? You don't think that the jury could find a defendant just guilty of delivery of a controlled substance?
No, I believe that weight is part of the essential elements of the offense. I point out something to you that's kind of an interesting angle. If one intends to go along this path and say that we know that there was some THC in this case, but we don't know how much, then there's a separate problem of the evidence being insufficient, and that is that if we don't know the amount of THC, There isn't sufficient evidence to support a reasonable inference that the defendant knowingly possessed a controlled substance. And for that rule, I would cite the court to KABAT versus State, K-A-B-A-T, found at 76 Wisconsin 2nd, page 228.
Why can't you say he's guilty of the offense, you don't know what the penalty will be, therefore you give him the least penalty. Now, the one reason I suggest to you that, and to Ms. Wellman, that the court's asking these questions is we had another case earlier in the month State versus Kane, C-A-I-N, and you're shaking your head, so you're familiar with it.
It was
a guilty plea case. It was not a trial. It was a question of whether the guilty plea is good in light of the fact that it was different evidence of how many marijuana plants were involved. Court was familiar with some federal cases that can be interpreted to say you're guilty of the offense, but you take the most or the least severe penalty if the state didn't prove that amount. That's not the way your whole argument is geared, though.
No, this case was a jury trial.
I understand that.
And the jury has to find the amount under our law. Now,
no, but the question is that an element or does it go to the penalty? And we heard the state argue that under Apprendi, it was not an element but went to the penalty.
But the problem here is if the jury has to find that, no matter what label we attach to it, and the jury does not do that because it is not submitted to the jury, then what is the remedy? Our Wisconsin statute says that when there is not a waiver of jury trial, the remedy is a new trial.
You're going in on a jury trial waiver.
Yes.
There was a stipulation in this case, right?
Yes, a stipulation of fact.
Now we've moved down to a waiver. Do you want to stay with sufficiency of the evidence for a while?
Yes, please.
Okay. You got a few minutes on it.
The second point that I wanted to raise is that we know from Jackson versus Virginia and this court's decision in Pollinger that the reviewing court must determine whether there was a rational or reasonable basis for the jury to reach its decision. Now, to me, those mean the same thing. Rational and reasonable mean being able to give a reasoned explanation. It's more than just a conclusion. A reasoned explanation is more than just having a belief. So my fundamental position is that what is wrong with this court's opinion in State versus Pollinger, and I refer you to the highlighted portions, is that they wrongly assume, these highlighted portions, that criminal trial evidence will always allow the jury to rationally exclude every reasonable hypothesis of innocence. And that is not consistent with the Mirko distributing line of cases that are cited in my written brief. There are very many civil cases over the course of 100 years that have said that oftentimes the evidence is not such that a jury can rationally choose between two alternative views, one of liability and one of non-liability.
You know, counsel, when I was reading the briefs in this matter in regard especially to your argument concerning sufficiency of the evidence, the thought came to mind that this argument could be made Could this argument that you're advancing be made in almost any circumstantial evidence case? In other words, is the nature of circumstantial evidence such that it could always lead to other hypotheses in addition to the one the jury apparently found by its verdict?
It's difficult to answer that in the abstract, sir. I conceive that there might be many circumstantial cases in which there is a rational basis in the evidence to choose between the alternative interpretations that might be drawn.
I agree with you. It is a difficult question. And one of the thoughts that came to my mind as I was reading this is Mr. Smith asking for a rule that in essence says in a circumstantial evidence case, it can't simply be based on circumstantial evidence. It has to have some piece of evidence that is not circumstantial. I'm not expecting a perfect answer from you. I'm just telling you that that's one of the thoughts that occurred to me.
No, I don't think that is my position, Justice Gableman. It's just that, from the fact that I was able to cite maybe a dozen civil cases over the course of 100 years, we know there have been thousands of civil trials, many of which presumably were based on circumstantial evidence that was found sufficient. So I think it's probably the rare circumstantial evidence case that actually produces a situation where the jury does not have a rational basis
to
decide.
It's one where it's really circumstantial.
I also think that most circumstantial evidence cases have some direct evidence as well. But again, I'm just speaking generally.
I agree with that.
Okay. I think because I want to talk a little bit about what are the inferences, interpretations in this case, and I'm going to move along as quickly as I can, we really ought to talk a little bit about possibilities, inferences, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It's interesting to note that possibilities may be probative of guilt. But this court has decided in the past that possibilities by themselves ordinarily are not enough to carry the burden of proof, whether in a civil case such as Mirko, where there were equal possibilities, or in fact in a criminal case. I have cited State versus X. Rel. Kanieski versus Gainon in my brief. And in that case, the state had presented evidence, physical evidence, in several different categories. Each of those categories could have connected the defendant to the crime scene. And the Attorney General argued that you should be able to add all of those possibilities up and sustain the finding of guilt. And this court said no. Adding up those possibilities was not sufficient to carry the state's burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I believe if we're going to be rational, you have to look at the items of evidence that are probative of guilt, even if they're just probabilities, and decide really how much of a possibility or probability they raise. To put it in different terms, how can I rationally add together the value of all of the coins in my pocket without first asking myself, what is the value of each of those coins?
Don't courts look at the totality of the circumstances all the time? I mean, what I noticed, it's obvious in your brief, the argument you made underscoring the point you're making now as you went through each piece of circumstantial evidence and presented an analysis and said this would not be enough to show guilt. And is the jury not permitted to take all of those things together and decide as a whole?
We don't know what the jury does, and we cannot control which way they look at it. But the question in this court is, what should the reviewing court do? And the reviewing court is charged with determining that there's a rational basis for the jury's verdict.
But there's no way a reviewing court can do that without essentially overruling a jury. You say there's no way to control what a jury does, but if it seems to me if we adopt the analysis you presented in your briefs that the reviewing court has to go through each piece of circumstantial evidence and make a determination whether that in isolation, that's what made me hesitate when I was reading your argument. It seemed to me that you were taking the position that viewed in isolation, there had to be one piece of evidence, simply viewed in isolation, that would have been determinative of guilt in order for the jury's verdict not to be overturned.
I frankly don't believe it's possible to rationally look at the evidence without discussing it individually. I'm willing to talk about it both ways with you this morning. But again, I don't know how you can determine the value of the coins in your pocket without looking at which ones are quarters and which ones are pennies.
But eventually you add it up to determine how much you have.
Yes. What is an inference? The reason I've been talking about alternative interpretations of the facts is that the word inference is can be used as a term of art. And what it means is a permissive conclusion that might be drawn, doesn't have to be, from one or more base facts in light of one's previous knowledge and experience. The important point here, though, is that an inference is not necessarily true, even if the premises are true. There's always some wiggle room there. For example, when people in the year 1400 looked at the ocean and saw a vast, flat area, and they looked at sailing ships travel over the horizon and disappear, they inferred that the Earth was flat. The premises were true. The ocean appears to be a vast tabletop. And the other premise is also true. Ships disappear over the horizon. But the inference they drew was not true. Now, what makes an inference reasonable? In my view, you have to look at both the aptness of the comparison that you're making to your previous experience and also the quantity of your previous experience. For example, we know as base facts that civil and military pilots see objects in the sky, metallic-looking objects that appear to travel in strange ways. We also know that some of those objects have been tracked on radar. Some people might infer that that means flying saucers exist, but I don't think that's a reasonable inference, because what we're comparing it to from our own experience is just not an apt comparison. We just don't have sufficient previous experience to do that.
Counselor, I want to redirect you a little bit. The state did not argue waiver to us, though the state did argue waiver to the Court of Appeals, and so reasonably there wasn't time spent on that issue in your brief and really in the state's brief either. I'd like you to give me, excuse me, your best argument about the written stipulation signed by the defendant and his attorney and the three or four different colloquies that the court had with the defendant are insufficient to show a waiver of a jury determination on the item of weight and quantity for the drugs.
My understanding of the colloquies and stipulations that were engaged in with respect to the weight of the marijuana was that they all dealt with whether there would need to be a witness come from the state crime laboratory to discuss the testing, the identification of the substance, and how much it weighed. There was never any discussion about not having a jury decide that. Now, it's easy enough to do a colloquy with respect to waiving a jury trial. This court has discussed that in a case called State versus Anderson. The person is supposed to know they have a right to have 12 people decide that there needs to be a unanimous verdict. And they're giving up that right, and that colloquy simply wasn't done in this case. There was no partial colloquy. The colloquy and stipulation all related to evidentiary facts.
Okay, so you don't take one of the colloquies that I thought was quite interesting is when the court said, "Is it true, Mr. Smith, you're not going to make the state prove what was in the box?" And you consider that only a focus on evidentiary, not having to prove to the jury who was there for the trial?
Yes. It certainly isn't clear that the defendant understood it to mean that the jury would not decide that issue.
Well, there was also a colloquy when the court specifically asked whether the defendant had been promised anything or let's see if I can find it for you so I can focus your comments a little better. The court says, okay, any promises or threats made to you to get to make your decision? And again, he's talking about not having information presented to the jury on this issue.
In many of the cases that are cited in the party's briefs, there is a stipulation of evidentiary fact, but the issue is still submitted to the jury. It is not taken away from the jury. Now, you might be right that Mr. Smith's lawyer anticipated that the jury would not be deciding this, but there's really no basis that I can recognize that Mr. Smith knew the jury wasn't going to be deciding this issue.
Okay, thank you.
I want to say one last thing about the sufficiency of the evidence. My yellow light is on, and then I have a couple quick things to say about the waiver of jury trial. Looking at the evidence as a totality, that's fine. Let's talk about that. I respectfully challenge the state, and I respectfully challenge the court to give a reasoned explanation if the totality of this evidence is sufficient. What is it about the evidence that shows that Mr. Smith had a guilty state of mind with respect to any of his conduct? And most importantly, that he had a guilty state of mind with respect to what he was charged with, namely that he knew intended and agreed that marijuana would be possessed with intent to deliver on or about September 20th, 2006. With respect to the waiver of jury trial, I want to say that the prejudice here lies in the nature of the tribunal that found Mr. Smith guilty. The right of jury trial is not designed to guarantee accurate fact-finding. So the overwhelmingness of the evidence doesn't really matter.
Counsel, I'm not going to take long, but if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying this is a lot like a felon in possession of a firearm case, where one element of the offense is that the defendant is a felon. Defendants will often stipulate that they have the prior felony conviction, but that element still goes to the jury, and the jury still technically has to decide it, even though the defendant has stipulated to that.
I believe that's correct.
Okay.
The state's position to adopt a harmless error test for all situations when the wrong fact finder, the wrong tribunal, determines guilt, I suggest is very precarious, because stipulations can occur in a number of different ways. For example, a defendant can request a bench trial, as the defendant did in Villarreal. And in a bench trial, the evidence might be hotly disputed. Or a defendant can stipulate to certain facts that aren't really arguable, and it can be taken away from the jury in that respect. Those situations, though, are different from when the court enters an erroneous jury instruction, because the defendant has triggered the stipulation or the request for jury trial. And so there's a difference there. Finally, I suggest that the state's theory of harmless error really has no foreseeable limit. If it's good enough for one element, then why is it good enough for all of the elements? Well, the Attorney General says today that we're not taking that position. Wait till next year. I mean, there's no logical end to the position there. I refer the court respectfully to what I believe is a clear and unambiguous statute. And as I pointed out in a letter to the court late last week, there are cases going back to the 1870s which indicate that jury waiver statutes have state constitutional significance, that under our state constitution, the right to jury trial in criminal cases cannot be waived without a statute authorizing a waiver. And the Supreme Court has repeatedly indicated in those cases that that is a matter of a legislative policy determination that is not for the courts. What the state is asking this court to do in this case is to interfere with that legislative determination.
What statute are you referring to, counsel?
I'm referring to statute 972.02, paragraph 1, which is the modern version of the statutes that go way back to 1911.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time is up. You've got 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is both petitioner and respondent in this court. The state asks this court to hold, first of all, that when an element of a crime is erroneously removed from the jury, that error is subject to harmless error review, and it does not result in automatic reversal.
Counsel, I have to stop you right there, because to me it is a really big deal as to whether this is an element or whether it is a penalty determination to be made by a jury. If it's an element and you don't prove it, the defendant is found not guilty. If it is not an element of the offense, but merely a determination of the amount of controlled substance that goes solely to penalty, that's different. Are you really saying that this is an element of the offense that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order for a defendant to be found guilty?
We are saying it's an element It goes only to the penalty, not to the substantive offense. But my understanding of Apprendi and Blakely is that we have to prove that penalty element beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury, as well as the substantive elements. That's why we call it an element. And I think the same harmless error analysis applies. The ultimate relief, if he were entitled to relief, might differ.
Okay, do you think then that instead of the way the jury instructions have been for quite some time, where someone is found guilty or not guilty of the possession with intent to deliver, and then after the jury makes that guilty or not guilty determination, they go on to answer the amount question. Do you think that's been wrong all these years?
No.
That really the amount should be an additional element of guilt or innocence?
No, I don't think that that's wrong. I think it's I don't think that makes any substantive difference.
Do you think that if the jury doesn't find an amount, the person's not guilty?
No, I think he's still guilty of the underlying substantive offense.
What's the sentence?
Well, that's the question, and I don't know for sure what the answer to that question is. Now, in a very similar situation in Villarreal, of course, we're asking that part of that be overruled, but we'll put that aside for now. Villarreal said when you had first or second degree intentional homicide by use of a dangerous weapon, the dangerous weapon was submitted to the jury as a separate question, just like this is. And in that case, the court held, well, if the dangerous weapon was wrongly decided, we just lop it off. He got the extra 5 years for that. You just take it off. Now, in this situation, we couldn't do that because the penalty doesn't work quite the same way. The Court of Appeals suggested in their decision that the remedy would be you give him the lesser offense, which would be anything under 200 grams, I believe. I'm not sure I have the numbers right, but it's in the statutes. Because if he possessed any, he possessed less than 200 grams. So I think if it's not harmless error and he ultimately gets a remedy, you may well be correct that it being a penalty element goes to what remedy he gets. He wouldn't get a new trial on the substantive elements. But I don't think it goes to the basic analysis of isn't an element in the sense of does the state have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, or to the sufficiency or to the harmless error arguments.
Counsel, in both of your briefs here, you many times refer to this as an element of the offense. In fact, your argument, Roman numeral number one, which you're on now, when the wrong fact-finding entity adjudicated the defendant's guilt on an element of the offense, that trial error is subject to harmless error. I mean, that goes throughout. Are you backing down then from your arguments in your brief and your several of your arguments that talk about the element of the offense? Are you backing down from that?
No, I mean, it's still an element of the offense in the big, if you look at the total of the offense, is possession with intent to deliver a controlled substance of X amount, just like he's either guilty or not guilty of homicide, intentional first-degree homicide while armed with a dangerous weapon. It's all part of the offense in that sense. And we did that intentionally because we want to make it clear to the court that even if this were a substantive element, as it was in Nader, where it was materiality of a fraud statute that didn't go to penalty alone, it was part of the substantive offense, that is subject to harmless error when the trial court decided it and should have had the jury decide it. So our use of it, although I didn't realize that by doing that I was creating confusion about the penalty aspect, and I apologize for that, we view it as part, let me put it this way, our harmless error argument doesn't differ depending on whether it's part of the goes to penalty or substantive offense.
Let me ask you about harmless error. We have a case that we put off from April.
Yes.
Lemoyne, in which I think the Department of Justice and the defendant agreed that the whole concept of how you define harmless error is now before the United States Supreme Court. which involves Nader and Chapman, as I understand it, and at the state level, Nader, Chapman, and Harvey. Does this case have to be put over, waiting that case, too?
I don't know if it has to be. It certainly could be, and it, you know, depending on what the United States Supreme Court says, it might shed light on Nader and the relationship between Nader and Chapman. In this case, because we view this as right in line, it's the same kind of error, just different offense and different elements, as Nader and Harvey, we think you could just apply the Nader test. I hadn't thought about the possibility of this being put over also. It may be wise to do that because we don't know how extensive the U.S. Supreme Court's decision will be.
Unless the court says there was no error, then you don't get to harm.
Right.
So was there error here?
We believe that there was error because if we correctly understand this court's prior cases, the defendant was required to personally, let me back up and say, he's required to personally waive his right to have the jury determine all of the elements.
Let's just back up even before that.
Sorry.
There's a difference between stipulating to introduction of evidence and waiving a jury trial on the element to which the evidence went. True?
True.
Okay. So now we can do your second stage. There's a difference between stipulating to a fact, right, or evidence that supports that fact, and waiving a jury trial on an element. What's the element here?
The element is the weight of the controlled substance.
Okay. Which is an element of two kinds of elements, according to the state, right? An element and a penalty element.
Right, or substantive, or underlying offense element, I guess you could label it.
Okay, whatever. All right. Okay. Now, with that framework laid.
Okay. We believe the record's absolutely clear that he stipulated to the fact, you know, as a matter of evidence, that the state didn't have to bring in, he would stipulate that the packages contained THC, marijuana that contained THC, and that the weight was over 10,000 grams.
So do you see this more as like a, you know, if you have possession, it's a misdemeanor. If you have second or subsequent offense possession, it can be a felony. So you can take that second or subsequent offense away from the jury by stipulating. Or do you see it more like, or neither of these, felon in possession of a firearm, where even if a defendant wants to stipulate, I'm a felon, I've been previously convicted, the jury still is instructed on that element, but they're told that the parties have agreed, and you have to accept that element as conclusively proved. The court doesn't take the element away such that the jury never hears about it in a felon in possession. That's why this element thing is a big deal to me. If it's an element of the underlying offense, you can't take it away from the jury. That's big.
Okay, I hope I'm understanding you correctly. But you can take it away from the jury.
They still are instructed. They're still told the two elements. They're just told it's conclusively proved.
But as in this case, what happened was they were told that, but then the judge told them, you don't have to decide this question because I am deciding this question, the amount question. Now, a judge could also do that with a substantive offense if the defendant waived his right to have the jury determine that element. So, for example, I suppose you could have an incest case where the defendant said, well, I think it would be prejudicial to me to have the jury hear all of the details about how I'm related to this person that I had sexual relations intercourse with. So I want to stipulate that that was my daughter, and I don't want the jury to decide that. I don't want them to be thinking about that. So he stipulates to it as a fact, and also he and his counsel waive the right to have the jury determine that element. and then that element would not be submitted to the jury, and the court would make a finding of that. And I think that would all be proper. So if you're suggesting that that couldn't happen at all, I don't agree with that. But maybe we're ships passing in the day here.
Does one be instructed at all on that element?
If he agreed to waive his right to have the jury determine that.
And the state took the stipulation. We've had cases where the state won't take the stipulation.
Right.
They want that evidence to go to the jury because they want the jury to consider it. The state doesn't have to agree.
Right, that's correct. Right? The state doesn't have to. And I just, as one caveat, when you were giving the example of the second offense, there may be an exception to that. There is for the repeater, and I'm not sure if that applies all the way through, that juries don't get that anyway because it's too prejudicial.
All right. Go ahead.
What are the precise words that the court should have used, in your view?
Oh, in talking to the defendant, I think the court should have simply asked the defendant, Mr. Smith, your counsel, and we talked about this in the instruction conference, and your counsel would prefer that this element of the amount of the controlled substance not be decided by the jury, that he's asking the court to decide that element, that issue. Do you agree with that? You have a right to have the jury determine that. Do you agree with that? And he would say yes or no.
And that the jury right to trial by jury means a unanimous 12. That's under Anderson.
Right. And we don't actually have a case that says, you know, what all you have to tell him when it's just an element or certain elements, but that certainly makes sense that you would include that.
Because what you're doing is waiving the jury, regardless of what the element is.
Right.
What you have to do is have a colloquy that fits our cases that constitute waiver. So you have to know you have a right to the jury. You have to know that the jury is 12-person unanimous in a criminal case, right?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, yes.
It's all set forth in Anderson and other cases.
Right.
Counselor, why don't we look at this waiver question as we have in the past if we think that the colloquy was defective and send it back to the circuit court to have the state prove that he did knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waive his right to a jury trial on the weight of the marijuana?
Well, you could do that. The reason that we didn't ask for that here is because in this case, what we're saying is even if, and we assumed in our briefs for sake of argument, I guess more or less because we didn't argue it, is that even if in this situation he didn't knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive his right to have the jury determine that element, our view is that under Nader and Harvey and Gordon and Ruenzio and that whole, all of the cases we talk about in our brief, that is subject to harmless error review. And that's what makes this different, I'm sorry, than the prior cases.
But we have to overrule Villarreal, though.
You do.
If we send it back, we don't have to overrule anything. We just have the state have to prove that this was more than just an evidentiary stipulation, that in fact the defendant knew the jury was not going to be deciding this particular fact.
If the trial court would find that, then that would be the end of the case. If the trial court didn't find that and said, no, state, I don't think that you've proved that beyond a reasonable or by clear and convincing evidence, then we would still be in the position of arguing that can be harmless error.
Right. I understand that. I have some concern that I share with Justice Ziegler about the casual way the term element is used, because, you know, if it really is an element that's totally tied to this crime and the state didn't prove it and there wasn't a waiver, could argue he just takes a walk. He's done.
Well, under Nader and Harvey, we don't believe so, particularly Nader, because Nader was an there was no penalty aspect to Nader. Nader was materiality of a fraud offense. And the court, you know, U.S. Supreme Court said that's an element. The state or the government had to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. In that case, there wasn't even any confusion about what did the defendant know or waive or not waive, because the court made a legal error. The court said, I think that materiality is a matter of law for the court. So even though the defendant objected, the court decided that element itself, didn't give it to the jury, and the United States Supreme Court said that was error. You deprived him of his constitutional right to have the jury determine that element, but it's subject to harmless error review. And it's our position that if that happens when it's over the defendant's objection, then it certainly can happen here, where the defendant stipulated to the underlying fact, and it's just that apparently the parties in the court didn't realize we need to also specifically make sure that on the record he's waiving his right to have the jury determine that, which is in this kind of a situation, they're very, very close, but they are two different things.
Counsel, here you have acknowledged that there was error. So what's in play is the harmless error analysis. The only thing that I really know about the U.S. Supreme Court case that's pending was what was in your motion to adjourn a case scheduled for next month. But it sure seems to me, based on that limited information, that the vitality of Nader, the scope, the application may be subject to further discussion. And yet, since you acknowledged error here, isn't the only thing we're talking about in your argument is really, from your argument, application of Nader here?
Well, the first question, of course, is whether this can be subject to harmless error at all.
That's right. That's right. But then you don't get to it.
But right. But if we win on that.
That's right.
As I recall, Vasquez, which is the U.S. Supreme Court case that's pending.
Has it been argued yet?
No, I believe it's scheduled for March 21st. Okay. Mm-hmm. March
21st. I thought it was this month. Go ahead.
Yes. That was some kind. I'm kind of drawing a blank here. It was some kind of an evidentiary error. It was not involving our legal issue of a court determining an element. And the controversy there appears to be, as best I can understand, defined as, is it the Chapman test? Is it Nader? Is there a test that's not quite either of those, which is, well, if there was overwhelming evidence to support or sufficient evidence, depending on how you phrase it, but overwhelming evidence to support guilt anyway, do we have to evaluate the impact of the error on the verdict? So, I mean, I think it's possible in that case the court would say, look, we're going to rethink the Nader formulation altogether, and that could impact this case, and say, no, we were wrong to rephrase it in Nader, we're just going to stick with Chapman. But I think that case doesn't raise the issue of whether the Nader error is subject to harmless error review.
No, but it'll change the application.
It may.
Depending on
right,
that,
it may not. Right.
Counsel, you just started to touch upon the question that I had in regard to your argument concerning Nader. You've made reference to it during your presentation today, but as I understand it from your brief, it is the state's position that because the error that took place here is not what has been called structural error under Nader, that in Nader, the United States Supreme Court identified several types of errors that go to the fundamental framework of whether the trial process itself was a fair forum. And your argument, as I understand it, is that the absence of a specific colloquy between the trial court and Mr. Smith, asking him expressly if he understood the right to have a jury decide the weight of the substance, did not run to structural error. Is that about it?
That's correct, because we believe that at the heart of this case is that the nature of the error here is that the jury did not determine an element it should have determined. The court determined it instead, and it doesn't matter for purposes of determining whether it's subject to harmless error, it doesn't matter how that came about.
Because the argument that you advance is it was not a structural error, it is therefore subject to the harmless error analysis.
Right.
Is there anything about any case pending in the United States Supreme Court which has either been argued or scheduled for argument that it where it is indicated that the United States Supreme Court is going to reexamine the framework that is set forth in Nader?
Not unless it's in some other case other than Vasquez that I'm not aware of, but I'm not aware of any.
I should have asked you if you were familiar with it. Okay.
No. But that doesn't mean there could be, but it's not ringing a bell. And
duly noted that your understanding of the United States
right.
Supreme Court docket is less than entirely thorough, as is all of ours.
Thank you. I did want to.
Roman, let me ask a question. Before you run out of time, your opposing counsel spent a lot of time talking about the sufficiency of the evidence here. Would you give us your response to that? Do you think the evidence was sufficient? And if so, why do you believe that?
Oh, we absolutely think the evidence was sufficient. And, I think our brief thoroughly lays out all of the evidence that the state presented. I think the main, as far as analysis goes or sort of legal principles, I think where we differ substantially is that he takes issue with the Court of Appeals saying we don't look at items of evidence in isolation. We look at the totality and whether the evidence as a whole was sufficient, and we think that that's absolutely correct. I also think that what he's really asking this court to do is to not look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, which you're required to do under Jackson versus Virginia and Pollinger, and to not accept all inferences, all reasonable inferences the jury could have drawn, but rather to draw its own inferences. When you look at all of the evidence put together, you have, it's our position that the jury was entitled to see these different individual items of evidence and the relationship between each other. They made it more or less credible or more or less likely. For example, the fact that the defendant introduced Shannon to Terry Thomas in and of itself, not necessarily nefarious. The fact that he gave her $400 several times during a period of about 3 months, amounting to over $1,200, when he apparently was seeking Social Security disability and, was not a person of wealth. Again, that increases the likelihood that he's involved in this. But when you also put that together with the fact that, he didn't just randomly give her $400, or he didn't give her $400 every third Monday. No, he gave her $400 each time only after she had received the packages that she had agreed she would receive at her home for Terry Thomas. After Thomas had come and picked up those packages, then the defendant came and gave her the $400. And she testified, he was giving her the $400 each time for receiving those packages. The jury was entitled to draw that same inference that she drew. Then you have David Melhorn, a man who was on probation, and when he saw on TV the arrest of Terry Thomas for this scheme where they had packages delivered to a third person that had marijuana, and then he got concerned that he would get in trouble because he had done a very same thing for Terry Thomas and Roshan Smith. He didn't want to get in trouble. He's on probation. So he went to the police and said during months that overlap these or coincide with these, Roshan Smith asked me if I would receive packages at my home address for him, and I agreed to do that. And each time the packages came, I called him. And Terry Thomas and Roshan Smith came and got the packages. Now, he didn't get money for it, but it's a very similar arrangement. And then David Melhorn also was asked, did Roshan Smith talk to you about being involved with a marijuana thing with a girl? And he said yes. But he said he wasn't worried about it because it's my word against hers. If the jury was entitled to put each of those things together and looking at the totality, see how each one reinforces the other and added together, although if you took one and looked at it alone, it might lead to either a reasonable inference of innocence or guilt. But the jury was entitled to say, drawing all reasonable inferences from all of those in their totality, there was sufficient evidence that he was involved in this possession of marijuana with intent to distribute scheme or acts that we're going on.
In Nader, that was a federal case involving the Sixth Amendment, the jury trial in the Sixth Amendment.
Right.
My understanding is that a jury trial is subject to the state constitution.
Right.
Rather than the Sixth Amendment.
Well, it's subject to both.
Okay. So it may not be a violation of the federal constitution on jury trial to not have a formal waiver, right?
Correct. It may not.
Helmet, may not. Well, they say here in Nader, the government argues correctly, we think, that the absence of a complete verdict on every element of the offense establishes no more than an improper instruction on the element of the offense violates the Sixth Amendment jury trial guarantee. And then they go on to say it's error. They don't really discuss jury trial, as I understand the Nader case. And then they go on, they say it's error, but it's subject to harmless error, and that not every constitutional error is automatically a new trial.
Right.
So our cases tend to say, like Anderson, you got to have a waiver of a jury trial if you're not going to give the jury an element. How do you reconcile that with Nader?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood the last few words you said about what our case is.
Our case, Anderson says, got to have a jury waiver, good colloquy on waiver, if you're going to eliminate an element for the jury, right?
Well, actually, Anderson was a waiver of a jury trial in its entirety, not an element.
Right, but set forth how you do a colloquy on waiver of a jury trial. Do you think there has to be a different colloquy if it's an element versus the whole trial?
I'm not sure. I don't see that anything would be gained by having a difference except to lead to even more possible confusion. But let me just make this clear. It is our position that requiring a colloquy is separate from the underlying right. And I think this court made that more clear in the recent Denson case. The right to a jury trial and the right to have every element decided by the jury are fundamental rights that the defendant has a right to unless he knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently waives them. Whether he has done that is the constitutional issue. Mm-hmm. Whether a colloquy is required at all is a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
The absence of a colloquy doesn't amount to a constitutional error. And the colloquy may be required, for example, by the court superintending powers.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we don't actually have a case that requires a colloquy for waiver of one element.
Right.
Then there's the other issue the defendant raises here, which is that, as I understand his response brief, apart from the Constitution, apart from either Constitution, the statute 972.02 gives him automatic reversal unless he did a waiver that was either on the record, orally, or in writing, and then has all the Anderson colloquy, which is separate from the statute. It's our position that 972.02 does not apply here because it applies to a jury trial, waiver of a jury trial. And the defendant here had a jury trial. There's no question about that. The jury heard all the evidence, it heard the arguments, it weighed credibility, it determined all of the elements except this one element that was taken away. So we don't think the statute on its face applies, and if it does apply and is extended to our case as Hawk did, then we believe if it really requires automatic reversal, then it's unconstitutional under interest of EB. And let me, since I mentioned Hawk and just got to it, let me just mention, too, that if you overrule Villarreal, we believe you have to overrule Hawk, too, because it is based on Villarreal, and it also improperly extended the automatic reversal rule to this fact situation.
EB was a termination of parental rights?
No, EB was a juvenile delinquency case, I believe.
Okay, and why do you think that applies?
Well, it says that the legislature does not have authority. Well, it would be unconstitutional.
Separation of powers.
Right, separation of powers. That's the words I'm looking for. Yes, that would be unconstitutional for the legislature to mandate automatic reversal, and we think that applies here as well.
Any other questions of Ms. Wellman? Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Schmall?
Thank you. I only have a few points to make in rebuttal. First, I would like to address the notion of element or penalty, notion of structural error, and the notion of what about United States versus Nieder and other cases? In my view, none of those dispose of the issue before the court, because in a statute that was enacted by our legislature, a statute that the courts have recognized for a long time is necessary as a matter of state constitutional law for there to even be a waiver of jury trial. The remedy is that if the procedures for waiver are not followed, the remedy is a new trial. So whether we label it as structural or not, whether we label it as an element or a penalty, it is something that must be proven to the jury. And if the statutory procedure for waiving a jury finding is not followed and not complied with, our legislature has declared that the remedy is a new trial.
Counselor, why don't we just send it back down to determine whether what is provided by the signed stipulation by the defendant and his counsel and the interactions with the court was sufficient to show that he did knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waive his right to a jury trial on the weight of the marijuana?
Well, I think the determination you're asking about is a question of law based on the facts of record as they exist. The purpose of the statute, I think, plainly, is to have the defendant make a contemporaneous indication of intent to waive a jury trial.
We have a lot of cases where the colloquy is not sufficient, and there's a second step. And that's to determine if the colloquy is bad, it's the state's burden then to prove that the colloquy may not have been sufficient, but did the defendant nevertheless knowingly and intelligently and voluntarily waive a right?
I understand what you're asking to be, why isn't this case like the cases where there was a partial waiver that was defective? And in those cases, there is a remand for a hearing. I believe, if I'm not confused, I'm getting confused. I thought I had the name on the tip of my tongue. But I remember at least two cases that raised the issue.
That would be a Bentley case.
And here, my view of the record is, and perhaps this is the only answer I can give you, that there was no waiver, no discussion about jury findings at all. It had to do with whether crime lab witnesses needed. It started out actually stipulating to that the report could be received without a witness testifying. And it gradually evolved, probably from pressure from the prosecutor, but I don't know that. I'm just surmising, to be a stipulation of substantive fact.
Well, it started out with the defendant's idea. He's the one that brought it up and wanted to have this stipulation entered into. But be that as it may, I have another question for you. If this is really an element of the crime and the waiver was no good, so the state, why aren't you arguing that the state failed on its proof and your guy just gets to take a walk?
I'm not sure I got lost there, but it is my position on Roman numeral one, the sufficiency of evidence argument, that my guy should walk. The evidence was insufficient.
All right. And he doesn't need a new trial.
Right.
The state gets one
shot. That's correct.
Shot.
He's entitled to a directed judgment of acquittal.
Yeah, you're basing it on sufficiency of the evidence. I was basing it on the state's failure of proof of an evidence that of a, quote, element that should go to the jury. But I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
What was court fine being paid $400 per package?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of the question?
Why was court fine being paid $400 to receive packages?
The record on that is shows that Mr. Thomas, the one who pleaded guilty to the crime, told her that she would be paid money if she received packages for him. The record shows no testimony as to what Mr. Smith believed or knew or understood that that payment was for. There was no explanation given, and apparently no questions were asked.
And may no inferences be drawn?
I don't think reasonable inferences can be. I mean, to me, it's just as likely, that Mr. Thomas asked Mr. Smith to do him a favor, just like he asked Ms. Courtbine to do a favor, for her to receive packages for him, and for Mr. Smith here, would you give some money to Ms. Courtbine that I owe her? I don't know of any basis in the evidence to exclude that as an equally likely interpretation. My red light has come on. I must sit down, unless I've not fully answered your question.
Any further questions? If not, I want to thank both counsel for their excellent briefs and for their discussion today of recurring issues. One, what does waiver mean and constitute, whether it's to one element or to the whole concept of jury trial? And two, when does harmless error apply and what does harmless error mean? We haven't heard the last of either one of those issues, let alone sufficiency of the evidence. So I want to thank you both on behalf of the court, and that concludes our hearing in 10-AP-1192 CR State versus Smith. We're going to take a few moments of recess so that the students here may leave if they wish, and additional students are going to enter the courtroom. We are in a few moments of recess.